This podcast is proudly brought to you by Infinity Media, incubating innovative businesses in the media industry.
Hi, I'm Gordon Muller. I'm the guru in the Doc and Guru podcast. Thanks for being with us. For those of you who don't know me, I've spent over 40 years in the media industry in South Africa and pretty much made it my home, my life, my passion. I have other passions, unfortunately, for my sins. I'm an Arsenal supporter and a Sharks supporter, so we're going to do pretty much everything on the show as it pertains to media, marketing, and money, but we don't take jokes about Arsenal or the Sharks.
I'm Doug Mateus, the doc on the show. And again, for those of you who don't know me, I spent 30 years in various companies in South Africa running different marketing functions. And the last job I had, I was privileged enough to work with a team that took the brand to the fastest growing brand in South Africa in 2018 with a 47% year-on-year growth. So that was a great achievement for the team, and I'm really proud of that. From a personal point of view, I do a little bit of cycling and also snow skiing, so we quite enjoy that. But again, today's discussion is around all things marketing and media.
Yep, that's right, Doc. All things marketing and media. No subject too big, no topic too small, no subject too hot to handle. Please get in touch with us on our Facebook page, follow us, like us, whatever it takes. We would love you to be involved with the show, and we really want to make it as inclusive and as energetic as I know this industry is capable of.
Good day and welcome to another episode of the Doc and the Guru podcast. Today, we're with David Blythe. David, former CEO of Yellowwood Brand Architects and also now the own consultancy. And today, we're going to talk challenges and particularly your role with Eat Big Fish.
Yeah, great. Great to be back in the studio again, Doc. Nice to see you. And David, thank you for being with us.
It's
a really exciting topic today. I'm going to switch off now because it's all marketing stuff. And when you just sort of cue me on the media word, I'll challenge you. How about that?
Yeah,
I'll be that media challenger brand today.
It's all interwoven and intertwined, as we well know. But certainly, yeah, you know, it is an interesting topic and something that, you know, I think I'd be very keen to hear more about and have been interested for a long time on challenges. And if you can just chat through, you know, and I think one of the starting point maybe, David, is to dispel that whole notion that a challenge is just a startup in the garage or a guy trying to cause trouble for the sake of picking a fight.
Yeah, I mean, I think people's first assumption when they hear the word challenger is that you're a number two and you're trying to be number one, or you're a number three and you're trying to be a number two. And it's not that at all. It can be that sometimes. Mm. And it often is, I guess, an underdog trying to be better than what they are at the moment, or to think differently about what they could be in the future. But it's very much more about a state of mind rather than a state of market. Mm. So rather than about playing position or about trying to beat the competition or be better than someone, it's about finding something that you could be better for, about changing the category dynamic and the way people choose the category, because you stand for something above the category and something perhaps that people haven't considered about the category before. And that's the way we like to explain it.
Yeah. Mm. And I think you're chatting just underdog, and that just triggers one of those 10 types of challenges. And you mean through the years, and it's been going 20 years now. So Eat Big Fish is not a new concept, certainly globally. And over those 20 years, Adam from London and the team, yourself included, have developed the 10 types of challenges and the characteristics. Now, I mean, I've always found it very interesting, and ironically, you and I did the exercise and we both came out as a people's champion. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about that? And as I say, the feisty underdog is just one of those particular categories.
So you just lost me there on the Eat Big Fish. So I'm going to find Eat Big Fish where on the website.
So we have a press office.
Yep.
On Biz Community,
okay,
which people can find quite easily.
Right.
bizcommunity.com/press office/eatbigfish.
Okay.
Or there's a global website called eatbigfish.com and a number of other property sites, thechallengerproject.com and overthrow2.com.
Okay. All right. So we can find this 10 challenger kind of grid and evaluate yourself on it as well?
Yes, Gordon. You'll find that on overthrow2.com. So it's overthrow with a numeric 2.com.
Okay.
And there we explain the 10 different kinds of challenger types. And we call those narratives, right? Okay. They're really stories that people tell about themselves that help characterize the type of challenger that they are.
Okay.
And to your point, Doug, you know, this has been developed over many, many years. Yes, 20 years ago is when Eat Big Fish started out of London. And the finer nuances of what it takes to be a challenger have been developed and then captured in a number of different books. The first one being Eating the Big Fish, and that talks about building something called a lighthouse identity, picking something really clear to stand for and projecting that so that people notice you even when they're not looking. And to develop that even further, the team have built a series of narratives. There are 10 of them, and the feisty underdog is one. People's champion, you and I share that. But there are a whole lot of other ones like the missionary, the democratizer, etc., etc., and lovely stories about and examples on that website of companies that have chosen that particular style of storytelling, of I guess projecting their character in a unique way that people won't forget them.
Is it at what point does it just become an optional thing, though? I mean, at the end of the day, no one in the world's ever found a caddy whose name is, you know, Dropshot or or Bogey or Shank, or, you know, they all call Lucky, or, you know. So, I mean, if I just wake up in the morning and I've got the world's most boring toothpaste, can I just decide I'm going to be an enlightened zagger or a feisty underdog or a local hero? Or, I mean, is it deeper than that? Is it just some sort of mood shift and I'm going to suddenly be a challenger brand?
Yeah, it's a lot deeper than that. It's very much more around leadership and culture, and I think that's where it starts. You know, a lot of the organizations that are successful with this kind of strategy have intentionally reassessed where they are within their market, and they've gone, okay, we're not going to win if we carry on playing the way we've been playing. We're not going to win if we carry on just delivering the basic functional elements of the toothpaste or whatever it is that you're selling. We need to pick something that makes us incredibly distinctive and that we can build a story around and that we can build a culture and set of values around, because most of these organizations are very values driven, and that's why you'll see many of them actually do originate from founder kind of culture.
I think one of those examples is Zappos in United States.
Absolutely.
As an example, you know, sort of, and even when they were acquired by Amazon, I think one of the conditions were that they could keep their culture. It was so strong and is so strong that, and I think the irony, Gordon, and, you know, looking at a marketing and media show, and we're now onto culture, those things are, in my book, so linked, you know. Absolutely. And certainly when I was chatting with Eat Big Fish a while back, one of the big attractions was the whole mind shift change in terms of culture, not producing another piece of creative. Of course, you're going to do that. That's just an outflow of a bigger, well, probably better thought through process. And I think so part of the attraction there was the deep thinking in terms of culture change and having internal advocates, people living and breathing and loving that brand, as opposed to just sticking something on TV or a digital platform or a piece of art tool.
Absolutely. I mean, it's two sides of the same coin, I think.
So, I mean, that's music to my ears in the sense that, you know, I grew up with Rosser Reeves and the USP concept, all right?
Right.
And the whole point of USP was that Rosser Reeves would go and literally look for a point of difference in the product itself. And that was the era of the torture tunnels and all that kind of stuff. And somehow that USP has morphed to, you know, parity products trying to differentiate themselves through creative expression, which for me is crazy. USP, it's got to be based in the product. And I guess if you're a challenger brand, you really have to have some inherent property which qualifies you as such.
Absolutely. And it does start with attitude. And it's the first step in the 8 credos of building a challenger brand is that you actually have to choose to change your attitude.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, the source of that actually talks back to where the Eat Big Fish name comes from. And it's the Avis idea of 1962, we try harder. And, you know, if you are number two, you better try harder or else. And in that ad, in one of those ads that they produced at that time, there was a piece of copy which read, we know what it's like to be the little fish.
Okay.
And that's why we try harder. So that's where the idea of Eat Big Fish came from.
Yeah. And as you say, it's a mindset that, you know, Gordon, along with the product and service, it's a lot of the time it is that it's an attitude, and it's that whole combined leadership driven culture strategy merger, you know, because it's that age old thing between the sort of gap between strategy and the actual culture. Sort of, you know, I've often said strategy is clever guys doing so-called clever things, but telling nobody, you know, and yet expecting the company to live that strategy when, you know, in terms of the work that you guys are doing, it is an all-in holistic, quite well thought through program that runs across multiple channels of the business.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we do these exercises, it's very workshop based. It's very co-created with the client, because people have to be involved in helping develop the outcome. It can't be done unto them. You can't get a PowerPoint presentation telling you how to be a challenger. You actually have to build it into your psyche as an organization.
Just looking at challenger brands, it seems to me, and we've been talking about challenger brands here as a standalone, like a number two or number three, but there's also the circumstance where number one brands who are tapering off at some point in sales begin to create internal challenger brands, and then you unleash a whole range of dangers, cannibalization not least of all. Can challenger brands be premium, or does it sort of follow that because you're number two, you're going to be slightly cheaper? Where does the pricing mechanism kick in on a challenger brand? Can I be a premium brand and a challenger brand at the same time?
Yes, I think you can be. I think you can. I think it covers all spectrums of the pricing equation. You know, you can find a brand in South Africa like a Capitec, which is a very value-driven brand, which I think I would definitely describe as a challenger. Definitely an organization that's tried to absolutely simplify what the banking market was about, and look at where is all the complexity and how do we take that away so that we make it easier for people. I think that's an example of kind of a price sensitive brand. I think there are other brands.
I mean, would you look at Discovery Bank as an upper end challenger?
That's a good example, yeah.
They do see themselves as a challenger, very much so.
Interesting, because they're really sort of on the other end of the banking spectrum. New entrant, new player.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, if you look at those two anchoring the sides of the banking scale.
Absolutely.
In terms of both challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. And bringing something quite new to the category, which didn't exist before, which is the way you behave changes how your fee structure works. And that's a very different equation that makes people reassess, I guess, the relationship they have with their current bank.
Because I know they did a lot of work with Dan Ariely a few years back in terms of behavioral economics, you know, at both Discovery and I'm just wondering, I don't know, I'm not that close to it, whether a lot of that stuff is now filtered into the thinking of behavioral banking out of behavioral economics.
I would think so, because as I understand it, the line that they're using at the moment is behavioral banking.
No, it certainly is. And that's why I was just, you know, because as I say, we brought Dan Ariely out about 2 years ago and spent some time with him, and he did mention some of the work, not in detail, but the work that he was doing around Discovery in terms of their mind shift and change of go to market.
Yes, and as we were talking, attitudinally, they're tackling the market on a very specific point of view that is at the core of their product and their mindset.
Yeah, it's questionable whether they're delivering. If you're sort of following the meme on social media, there's lots of interesting commentary by some fairly high-level players who are questioning whether it's smoke and mirrors, which brings us back to one of our earlier conversational points. Is it just me deciding I'm going to be a caddy and I'm going to call myself lucky, or do I genuinely have a behavioral insight which is modifying the way I deal with my clients? I'm not seeing a lot in the social media space which seems to affirm the latter. It just seems to be a claim at this point in time.
You're listening to The Doc and the Guru, proudly brought to you by Infinity Media.
Yeah, I mean, I think these things have to go beyond claim, right? And I don't know the actual circumstance. I don't know the truth of what people are expressing on social media, but I do think if we're talking challenges in general, one has to be very, very specific about if you're going to make a claim and you're going to pick a point of view and you're going to focus everything in your business just around that one specific point of view, boy, had you better get delivery right.
If you had a favorite in terms of that latter point, you know, a brand that's really kind of epitomizes the whole Challenger ethos for you in terms of delivering, is there any one favorite brand around the world that just kind of resonates with you?
At the moment, or
no, just generally. I mean, is there a classic case study that really just turns you on this particular issue?
I mean, the quintessential Challenger ever, and the ones that actually started the kind of David versus Goliath direction of Challenger thinking is Avis. So people around the world respect that, right? As a brilliant reference point. Globally, at the moment, I think there's some interesting brands that are doing it in ways that you wouldn't necessarily realize. When I say Audi, for example, Audi in North America is being very, very good at focusing their efforts around challenging the future of what automotive is. I think T-Mobile globally is a really good example of a brand that has taken an incredibly strong stance, has really activated that in very memorable ways, and through very provocative communication in the US.
Yeah. No,
you would know a lot about that.
100%, David. I mean, they have been very aggressive, and as we know, you know, the United States allows for comparative advertising, and they've certainly used that. And they're not been scared to go out and really have enjoyed, in my opinion, a very prominent position as a challenger. Yes. But I mean, just talking globally, Virgin, is that still up there? I mean, if I look back at 20, 30 years ago, it was, you know, Richard Branson up against British Airways, against the music companies at that stage, the trains.
Yeah.
Everything he seemed to touch at that stage was, you know, just turned to gold.
Yeah, that was his thing, wasn't it? Be the people's champion, go into a category and actually make it for the people instead of for the corporate.
Yeah.
And I think he did that exceptionally well. It seems to have kind of fizzled out a bit, if I'm not if I'm not wrong, in, I guess, the corporatization of Virgin, perhaps. I mean, I know it's still a different kind of business structure. It's not a big conglomerate corporate, but we don't see a lot of that in the brand attitude globally.
Yeah, I don't, I'm not that close to it. I don't see it there. And I think as the average consumer, it's interesting just to do the normal outtake. You know, there was, as a normal consumer, when I consume normal media, what is my feeling? You know, do I see myself as somebody who wants to side with that brand? And certainly 20 years ago, I think a lot of people would take Branson's point of view on things because they'd never met him, they'd probably never bought the brand, but they wanted to be like that. You know, I look just, you know, internationally and just chatting to some of the guys and your colleague, Chad, in New York. I had the privilege of meeting with him a few months ago at his office, and he was telling me about New Balance, the running shoe company, 105-year-old company.
Yeah.
Quite interesting. And they said to Eat Big Fish United States, look, we're not challenging Nike and Adidas. Please, let's be very clear. We're seeing a flattening of certain revenue streams. Work with us. And I'll fast-track the answer. And it came to two segments that are growing, certainly in America. One is walking, and the other is yoga.
Yeah.
So again, if you look at the work that has been done into those two segments, making them more relevant as a challenge. And I think, Gordon, it speaks to your earlier point in terms of segmented analysis, you know, companies that have divisions within divisions and lines within lines, et cetera, et cetera. And prior to that, Chad was saying that New Balance almost poo-pooed those two ideas, and that it wasn't sexy, it wasn't where they wanted to be, but certainly that is what they adopted and have done really well in those two lines. And again, as I say, not a startup, a 105-year-old company, but with a challenger mindset as opposed to a state of market.
Absolutely. So what I really love about that New Balance example is the fact that they've been brave enough to focus not on the entire market and try and cover off what Adidas and Nike perhaps are doing and to compete directly against them, but to actually pick two very specific segments and do that to the best of their ability and actually focus all their efforts around it. And that's the secret sauce, right? Is if you can be brave enough to pick something and to stand for it and to have a belief system, that then if you are like that and you characterize yourself like that as an organization and you come across like that as an organization, it creates desirability and affinity and belonging, because you go, actually, you think about that in a human sense. You like people who know what they stand for. You like people who, whether you like their value system or not, at least they've taken a stand, and they believe in it so wholeheartedly that you've got to respect them.
Yeah, absolutely.
I relate, you know, to that story, the New Balance story, not least of all because I think I've got one of the original pair of running shoes myself, which is quite handy.
I'm quite, and not shorts.
I'm quite attached to them. But I like the thought that, you know, there's an absolute brand value which can be attached to a challenger brand. I'm not a challenger brand purely by virtue of my relationship with another bigger brand.
Yes.
So it poses the question in my mind, though. Would I be correct in thinking of Pepsi as a challenger brand in that sense? Or were they a challenger brand and now they're in a post-challenger space and it's actually Dr. Pepper's is the challenger brand? What's the hierarchy of soft drinks then? When do you stop being a challenger brand just because you're number two?
Well, I'm not sure I see Pepsi as a challenger brand, actually. I think that would be a kind of default natural assumption just because of where they are relative to Coca-Cola. Mm. If I think about some of the more recent communication from Pepsi globally, I think they've made some ghastly errors, which don't necessarily put themselves into culture in the right way. They look like they're actually making some massive contradictory statements relative to what people actually think about their lifestyles, etc. And they're almost trying to insert themselves into people's lives rather than being natural.
Like the drunk uncle trying to dance at the 21st birthday party. Sometimes Pepsi adds, trying too hard to be cool. I totally get that.
Well, Gordon, it's unfortunately that time. You know, it's running out.
Yep.
And I mean, David, just again, thanks very much for the time that you spent with us. How do people get a hold of you, David? If someone wants to find out more about challengers, are they a challenger? How do they become? Can they sit with you? Is there a website? Can they get a hold of you on social platforms?
Yes, absolutely. So I can give my email address directly. So david@eatbigfish.com, which is pretty simple and easy. Also via the Biz Community Press Office, all my contact details are there. And I'm on most social media platforms anyway at DV Blythe on Instagram and Twitter and LinkedIn.
Okay.
Dave, thanks for coming into the studio. Doc, thanks again for the insights. It's really fascinating stuff. And I guess we need to probably develop this line of thought with more introspection about the local brands how this plays out in the mindset of South Africans. And again, just a little final question, Dave, and you can have the final word then. I think South Africans love an underdog. I think we loved winning the World Cup, not least of all because we went and there's a bunch of losers and came out a bunch of winners. So is there something in the South African mindset which predisposes us to challenges? And leave a final word to you. You can wrap it up.
Yeah, I think historically, though, as a country, we're quite corporatized and quite rule-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And so not breaking the rules or stepping out of line is actually quite a difficult thing. Particularly if you try and do that in a larger corporate organization. But what we need as a country is more challenges, right? Mm. We need more entrepreneurs. We need what the National Development Plan is trying to do. Organizations that can perhaps create new markets, create new jobs, create new opportunities. And with that, I would encourage as many people as possible to think about this in that light, right? To think about this as an opportunity in that light. How do you create something that, if you think the market's too scary and too big and too corporate, actually, is there another way to change that market dynamic completely? Can you be the next Outsurance, or can you be the next Kahlula, or can you be the take it on? There are different ways to think. It doesn't just have to be about capital and people. One can think about the scarcity of your resources as an advantage if you put a challenger mindset on.
Great. There we have it, guys. David Blythe talking challenger brands on the Doc and the Guru podcast.
And so that was another episode of the Doc and the Guru. Please don't forget to get a hold of us on Facebook, like us, follow us, subscribe to the podcast. And then from my side, you can get a hold of me on LinkedIn, Dr. Doug Mateus. I'm very active and very keen to hear about your views. And certainly will respond, and hopefully we can bring that into the show.
Thanks, Doc, and it's Gordon Miller, the Guru, signing off. Thank you for being with us and listening into this podcast today. You can pick up the discussion with me on my Twitter handle, @MzanziMedia, and I'd love to engage with you on any of the issues that we've taken on in the show. And take us at our word. This is really going to be an open forum. There are no subjects that are taboo, and we'd love to have some of the younger, more under-listened, if that's the correct phrase, voices to join us in this discussion. Thanks for your time.
The Doc and the Guru, proudly brought to you by Infinity Media, incubating innovative businesses in the media industry.